We've spent a lot of time recently hanging out in the somewhat smoky, gloomy cafes of Paris with Jean-Paul Sartre.
A lot of time.
Yeah, quite a bit. And if you take Sartre at his word, life can feel like this constant, exhausting battle. You're alienated, I'm alienated, and we're all just staring at each other, trying not to get, turned into objects by someone else's gaze.
It is a really heavy lens to look through. It paints a picture of the human condition that is defined almost exclusively by conflict and isolation. I mean, hell is other people, as his famous line goes.
Exactly. It's dramatic, sure, but it's also incredibly lonely.
Well.
But here's the good news, and this is really the mission of today's deep dive. That wasn't the end of the story.
No, it wasn't.
We're opening the windows today. We're looking at a fascinating lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes that basically says, hey, put down the Sartre for a second and look at the bigger picture. We're calling this the Other Phenomenologists.
That's right. And it's not just a laundry list of names to memorize for a test. It's actually a progression, a rescue mission, really. We're going to trace a path that moves away from that bleak, isolated existence Sartre talked about.
Right.
We'll look at how we understand our bodies, how we interpret texts, and eventually we're going to stare into the abyss where some thinkers argue that meaning itself might just be dead.
So from the lived body to the death of meaning, and hopefully back to some solid ground, sounds like a philosophical roller coaster.
It absolutely is.
So where do we start? Who is the first brave soul to stand up to Sartre and say, actually, maybe we don't all hate each other?
That distinction belongs to Gabriel Marcel. He was a French Catholic philosopher writing around the exact same time as Sartre, though he actually rejected the label
Oh,
existentialist.
really?
Yeah, he felt the term had been co-opted by Sartre's atheistic brand and just carried way too much baggage. He preferred to be called a philosopher of existence.
Little rebranding. Smart move. So what was his specific beef with Sartre?
Well, Marcel felt Sartre was being a bit of a drama queen about relationships.
Yeah.
Remember Sartre's idea of the for itself, the subject, and the in itself, which is the object? Sartre argued that in any relationship, one person is always negating the other. It's a constant power struggle to see who is the subject and who is the object.
Right, the staring contest.
Exactly. Marcel looked at that and said, "This is a massive distortion of reality."
So he thought Sartre was seeing a fight where there just wasn't one.
In a philosophical sense, yes, Marcel argued that Sartre failed to distinguish between negation, which is active conflict, and simple disengagement, or just drifting apart.
Let's unpack that difference because it sounds crucial for how we interact with people every day.
Think about riding a subway car. You're surrounded by people, you aren't deeply connecting with them, you're in your own world. That is disengagement. You are detached.
Right, you're just staring at your phone or the floor.
Exactly. But Sartre acts like that detachment is the same thing as active negation, as if you are mentally destroying everyone around you to preserve your own freedom. And Marcel says, "No, that's absurd. Just because we aren't connecting doesn't mean I'm actively negating your
That
existence."
makes so much sense. Sometimes you just drift. It's not always war.
Precisely. And this leads to Marcel's key insight. He says relationships actually have two poles. On one end, you have alienation. Sure, that happens. We do objectify people. But on the other end, you have love. You have communion.
Okay.
And human experience isn't just stuck in alienation. It oscillates. It swings to and fro between these two
Like
poles.
a pendulum.
Exactly like a pendulum. And that
Yep.
is a much more optimistic and honestly a more accurate description of how we actually live. We have days of isolation and we have days of deep connection.
I really like that. It allows for the possibility of real connection without denying that, yeah, there is a struggle sometimes. Okay, so Marcel gives us hope for relationships, but what about the self? Because Sartre had this idea that we're just this intentionality, this transparent spotlight of consciousness with nothing behind it.
Right, that brings us to Maurice Merleau-Ponty. He was arguably the most distinguished French philosopher of the 50s and 60s. He really took the baton after Sartre became a bit passé. And Merleau-Ponty had a massive problem with Sartre reducing the self to just intentionality.
Because if I'm just a spotlight,
There's no me shining the light.
right, if you eliminate the subject, the actual who, then you can't really have a subject-object relationship anyway.
Exactly. Merleau-Ponty argued that there has to be some enduring personal identity. We aren't just created from scratch every single second, totally free from our pasts, like Sartre claimed. And his solution to this was what he called the lived body.
The lived body. That sounds distinct from just, say, a biological carcass or a machine we drive around.
It is very distinct. He's saying that our concrete experience of the world is a bodily experience. We don't just float around as abstract minds or ghosts in the machine. We experience life through our bodies.
So when I look at a coffee cup on my desk, I'm not just a brain processing the geometry of a cylinder. I'm a hand that wants to hold it, a mouth that wants to drink it.
Spot on. The body is the anchor. It provides that continuity, that anchor of identity that Sartre seemed to completely ignore. My history is written in my body, my habits, my physical skills, my scars. I am my body in a way that goes far deeper than just ownership.
So we've got Marcel fixing relationships by introducing love, and Merleau-Ponty putting us back in our bodies so we aren't just floating ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
But the lecture we're looking at takes a sharp turn here.
Yeah.
We move from just existing to interpreting.
Yes. This is the big shift toward hermeneutics.
Which is a word that scares people.
It does, but it really just means the science or theory of interpretation. How do we understand a text? How do we understand a symbol? How do we understand each other? And the key figure here in the 70s and 80s is Paul Ricoeur.
Ricoeur, what was his specific angle?
He moved beyond just existence to the structures of how we understand our existence. He looked at things like freedom, guilt, and language. And he was very critical of the structuralists of his time.
The structuralists. These are the guys who say language is just a mathematical grid we impose on the world.
Essentially, yes. They viewed language and culture as these rigid artificial systems where everything is just a code. Ricoeur wanted to get to the essential structures of being, how we actually experience guilt or freedom, not just treat them as linguistic games. He wanted to keep the human element alive in the interpretation.
And speaking of interpreting the human condition, we have to mention Paul Tillich. He's in this mix too, right? But he's a theologian.
He is, but he used the phenomenological method, which is why Dr. Holmes includes him in this lecture series. Tillich is fascinating because he uses this philosophical toolkit to define faith in a very specific way. He calls it an ultimate concern.
Ultimate concern. I've heard that phrase. Unpack that for us.
Phenomenologically, if you look at a human being, faith isn't just believing in magic or dogma. It is a centered act where your whole being is directed towards something of ultimate importance.
So it could be money.
It could be money. It could be your career. It could be your nation, your family.
So basically, everyone has faith. By that definition, everyone has a God.
Exactly. Everyone has an ultimate concern. And Tillich argues that phenomenologically, God is the only true object of that ultimate concern that doesn't eventually let you down.
So he uses philosophy to describe the human feeling the anxiety, the need for meaning, and then uses theology to answer it.
Spot on. It's what he called apologetic theology. He uses phenomenology to pose the questions, like, why do we have existential anxiety? And then he offers the Christian message as the specific answer to those exact questions.
Okay, so we've covered the body, relationships, and faith. But now we get to the part of the source material that really changes how we think about reading. Not just reading books, but reading people, reading the world around us. We're talking about Gadamer.
Hans-Georg Gadamer. This is really the mainstream of contemporary hermeneutics. If you want to understand how we read and understand things today, you have to grapple with Gadamer. But to really get him, we have to look at the history of the grid, as Dr. Holmes calls it.
The grid. This is the lens we look through.
Right. So let's go back to the Enlightenment, the scientific view. Reading was seen as entirely objective. The text is a bucket of facts. You look at the data, you use inductive logic, you draw conclusions. It was clean, scientific, and totally detached.
Like downloading a file. No emotion, just raw data transfer.
Exactly. But then came the Romantic era, and specifically Friedrich Schleiermacher. He swings the pendulum to the complete opposite side. He believed that to interpret a text, you had to uncover the author's subjective intention.
He was the get inside the author's head guy.
Yes. He thought reading was a psychological act. He believed there was a divine spirit running through everyone. So by finding the author's intent, by feeling what they felt, you were tapping into that spirit. It was almost like telepathy.
So the Enlightenment is data extraction, and Schleiermacher is mind reading. But Gadamer comes along and says, not quite to both of them.
Gadamer shifts the focus entirely. He says interpretation isn't about being an objective robot, and it's not about telepathy with a dead author. It's an I-thou relationship. It's a dialogue.
A dialogue with a book. That sounds a bit metaphorical.
It is, but it's profound. Gadamer argues that we all come to a text with prejudice.
Yeah.
Now, in English, prejudice sounds bad. We think of bigotry or bias, but he means it etymologically, prejudgment or pre-understanding.
It's our baggage, our background.
It's your grid. You have a set of expectations based on your culture, your history, your language. You cannot turn this off. The Enlightenment idea of being a blank slate is a complete myth.
So if I read Romeo and Juliet, I'm reading it through the grid of a 21st century person who knows about dating apps and modern romance. I can't help it.
You can't. And Gadamer says you shouldn't even try to suppress it. Instead, you use it. You ask the text a question based on your grid. The text answers, perhaps showing you something that contradicts your grid. That answer forces you to reshape your question. You go back and forth.
And this leads to his most famous concept, the fusion of horizons.
The fusion of horizons. It's a beautiful image. Your horizon, your perspective today, and the text's horizon, say, Shakespeare's perspective in 1600 begin to merge. You don't become Shakespeare, and Shakespeare doesn't become you. But the gap narrows. You create a shared meaning.
But what makes that possible? If I'm reading a text from 500 years ago, how do we actually bridge that gap? Why aren't we just two ships passing in the night?
Gadamer says it's because we share an effective history. We share a common culture, or at the very least, a common humanity carried by language. Language is the bridge that allows the horizons to meet. We are already connected to the past before we even open the book.
That feels incredibly constructive. We're building bridges. We're fusing horizons. We're feeling pretty good about understanding things. But here's where the deep dive takes a dark turn. We have to talk about the collapse of meaning.
Yes. Enter Jacques Derrida and the deconstructionists.
This is where things get really slippery. I feel like deconstructionism is a term people throw around at dinner parties to sound smart. But what does it actually mean for our ability to know things?
It's a radical skepticism. They challenge the very idea that language can carry fixed meaning at all. They view language not as a bridge like Gadamer did, but as an artificial structure imposed on things. Deconstruction is the process of taking that structure apart just to show that it doesn't actually work.
So if I say the cat is on the mat, Gadamer says we can agree on that meaning through dialogue, Derrida would say.
Derrida would start pulling at the threads. He would argue that the structure of language is given by the author unconsciously, and that structure is never fully revealed. Cat defines mat defines floor, and it's just an endless chain of references. Because language is artificial, the reference to the real world is inconsistent. Therefore, fixed, absolute meaning is impossible.
That sounded chaotic.
It leads straight to relativism. If the text is inscrutable, then any interpretation is just another artificial structure we superimpose on it. So a plurality of interpretations are all valid or invalid because there is no fundamental truth to get at.
And this jumped across the ocean to America too, right? With Richard Rorty.
Oh, it hit America hard. Richard Rorty wrote a famous book called Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature, and the title tells you everything. He attacked the representational theory of knowledge.
Which is the idea that our mind acts like a mirror reflecting reality.
Right. For centuries, philosophers thought the goal was to polish the mirror of the mind so it reflected nature perfectly. Rorty came along and smashed the mirror.
He shattered it.
He did. Rorty argued that since we can't have knockdown drag-out proofs,
right,
since we can't have absolute certainty, like a perfect reflection, we have to be skeptics. We can't know the truth with a capital T. So he suggests we should just settle for interesting dialogue.
Interesting dialogue. It sounds nice and democratic, but it feels a bit empty if you're actually looking for answers. If I ask, is gravity real? And Rorty says, well, that's an interesting perspective. I'm not sure that helps me when I'm standing on a ledge.
Exactly. He equates truth with what our peers will let us get away with saying. It becomes entirely social, not factual.
And this is where Dr. Holmes, in our source material, steps in with a pretty sharp critique. This is the aha moment of the lecture for me. He calls Rorty out on a massive logical fallacy.
It is the pivotal moment. Holmes points out that Rorty is presenting a false dilemma or an illicit disjunction.
Walk us through the trap Rorty sets here.
Rorty acts like there are only two options in the universe. Option A is absolute certainty, the perfect mirror of nature, godlike knowledge. Option B is total skepticism. We can't know anything for sure.
And since we obviously aren't gods.
Rorty says, well, we can't have option A, so we must be stuck with option B.
But Holmes says, wait a minute, there's an option C.
Exactly. Holmes calls it the third way, which has actually been used throughout the history of philosophy. It's called critical realism, or sometimes probabilistic knowledge. He references the Scottish realist Thomas Reid here.
So what is critical realism? How does it solve the problem of the smashed mirror?
Critical realism splits the difference. It says, first, we have a direct awareness that an object exists. That's the realism part. We aren't hallucinating the world. When I see a car on the road, I am seeing a real object.
Okay, so we're grounded in reality. What is the critical part?
The critical part is admitting that our understanding of what that object is requires reflection, and it is subject to correction. I see the car, but I might be wrong about the model. I might think it's a Honda when it's actually a Toyota. I might misjudge its speed.
So I know it's there, but I might need to take a closer look to get the details right.
Right. And here's the kicker. Just because you might be wrong about the make of the car doesn't mean the car doesn't exist or that you can't know anything about it at all. Rorty throws the baby out with the bathwater. He says, if you can be wrong, you can't know truth. Critical realism says you can be wrong, so you check your work, you dialogue, you refine your understanding.
That feels like such a relief. It rescues us from that paralyzing skepticism where nothing means anything. We don't need absolute godlike certainty to have valid knowledge.
We can have substantial probabilistic knowledge that grows and corrects itself over time. It validates the Gadamerian idea of dialogue. We correct our understanding as we go without falling into the trap of saying there is no truth.
It essentially says the bridge holds. It might sway in the wind. It might need repairs, but it holds. We can cross it.
Exactly. And that allows us to engage with the world and with texts. Meaningfully.
So let's recap this journey, because we've covered a massive amount of ground today. We started with the absolute bleakness of Sartre.
The smoke-filled room where hell is other people.
And we moved to Gabriel Marcel, who reminded us that we oscillate between alienation and love. We aren't stuck. Then Rilla-Ponty gave us back our lived bodies, anchoring us in the physical world.
Then we shifted to interpretation with Gadamer, showing us how our horizons can merge with a text through dialogue, using our history as a bridge rather than a barrier.
And finally, we looked at the abyss of deconstructionism, where meaning collapses and the mirror shatters, only to be pulled back by the sturdy logic of critical realism.
Which reminds us that we can know things, even if we aren't infallible. We can have confidence without arrogance.
It really highlights that this stuff applies to everything. When you're reading the news, listening to a partner, or just trying to understand a book, you're bringing a grid. You have prejudices, in the Gadamer sense.
You do. And the goal isn't to erase that grid, which is impossible, but to be aware of it. To let the reality you're engaging with reshape your grid. To let the dialogue happen.
Before we go, there's one final provocative thought from the source material that's still spinning in my head. It's about that concept of authorial intention.
Oh, right. The question of whether the author is the final authority on their own work.
Yeah. The source mentions that literature teachers and deconstructionists often claim a text takes on a life of its own. Dr. Holmes even mentions how people read his own writing and find meanings, deep theological connections that he never consciously put there.
It raises a fascinating mystery. Does the author actually know what they mean? Or is meaning something that happens to us when we read, regardless of what the writer intended? Is there a subconscious meaning that leaks out, or does the text grow beyond its creator the moment it's published?
A little mystery to leave you with. Next time you write an email or send a text, ask yourself, is the real meaning what you thought you wrote, or is it what the other person reads? Thanks for diving deep with us.
See you next time.